Welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Eric Cohn.
I'm Ann Thompson.
And we've got plenty to discuss, as I know you're coming to New York to join me for the Tribeca Film Festival soon enough. But I got to tell you, for all the film items that we have on our agenda this week, really what I want to do is tell you that after all these years of forest fires wafting through LA, I finally feel your pain because it got smoky up in here this past week.
It looks very apocalyptic.
I'm still recovering.
Very Blade Runner.
It was very Blade Runner 2049. You know, correct. The hues were very specifically Roger Deakins out my window the other day.
How did it feel to walk around? I hope you're not running in it.
No. Fortunately, I do have a treadmill in my building. It was very strange. You know, I think it kind of crept up on all of us, that sense of something different in the air. You know, someone mentioned to me something about, you know, forest fires, and we've seen some dramatic sunsets in the past and things like that. But it was that campfire scent in the air when you went outside where you finally, you know, it was like you could tell. And then the media report started and then it really got thick and it was like, oh, this is not great. So that was a couple of days ago. That was, you know, middle of the early part of the week, Tuesday. And then Wednesday, it wafted through again. And here was the opening night of Tribeca Film Festival right around the corner. So I started wondering, you know, are they going to postpone? I mean, we heard about Broadway shows shutting down. Jodie Comer walked off her one woman stage 15 minutes into a performance.
She couldn't breathe, poor woman.
And then Hamilton postponed it. So a lot of stuff started to happen. And it felt like, you know, not COVID 2.0 per se, but that similar sort of vibe where it was suddenly like a public health emergency and everyone had to make these hard decisions in real time.
So are you running around the city with a mask on?
So the irony is that everybody's busting out their COVID masks that they used to put on when they went inside and take off going outside. And now it's the other way around. And with respect to Tribeca, I mean, they're showing movies, right? So indoors, theoretically, is okay.
So they went on with their opening.
They went on with the show. They had a pre-show or a ceremony beforehand with the mayor, Eric Adams, who, of course, you know, is the person dealing with the whatever you want to call it, a health crisis in the city, and still showed up to give a key to the city to Robert De Niro and announced De Niro Con, which will celebrate his 80th birthday later this year. But you know what? Eric Adams likes to party. Nothing's going to keep him away from that. I'm not saying this is a good or bad thing, but he did it. So if the mayor did it, of course, the show is on. And yeah, it happened. It was an opening night of Tribeca.
What did
not
they show?
Film festival. It was a film called Kiss the Future, which actually had its world premiere in Berlin in February. So this was, I suppose, the North American premiere, and produced by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Matt was there. This is a documentary about when U2 basically helped raise awareness for Sarajevo in the 90s and incorporated a bunch of material into their live shows from people who were there. And then
part of the building up of the U2 legacy.
Yes, it's very
book, his show, you know.
Yes, 100%. I mean, it's very much this sort of celebratory thing. I mean, I can tell you that a lot of people I saw at the after party really enjoyed watching the movie because it's a feel good documentary. And if you like U2 and if you feel, you know, troubled by the state of the world today, say what's going on in Ukraine or whatever, this story of like a big rock band using its influence to actually affect change, it is affecting. It's just, you know, the filmmaking is pretty straightforward. You know, it'll have a good life on streaming, I'm sure. I can't imagine it being an awards player, although I did see the Academy folks in the room scoping it out because they're in New York for the festival. But, you know, Tribeca usually opens with crowd-pleasing docs. And I had heard there had been some discussion that they were going to maybe have a performance afterwards because they like to have that.
Whoa,
sort of thing.
That would have been something. Not
yeah, and I think the determination was because there is a wartime context, you know, having Bono march out with a guitar afterwards might not be the right kind of thing. So they didn't do that. They just had a party afterwards. And now we're into this festival and it's happening. I'm be curious to see, you know, how the smoke situation affects turnout for things, but it's always kind of a crapshoot with this festival in terms of turnout because there's a lot of different stuff happening. You know, they dropped the word film a couple years ago, but it's still a film festival and it's got a lot of movies and a lot of them are not higher profile. So it's always a challenge to figure out, well, what are people actually going to take their time?
Just like Sundance, I tend to pay attention to the docs. So that's where I'm focused. I'm going to look at the league, you know, Sam Pollard's movie about the Negro Leagues,
sure.
and all the great players that came out of there and how they moved into the mainstream baseball playing. But I'm fascinated by that kind of look at history. And,
right.
and it's a part of the world that we don't get to see, you know, look under the hood and see what.
Really, yeah, always show up there for Sam Pollard anyway. Yeah. I mean, he's a great director. I love that the MLK FBI film that he
absolutely.
Made.
Absolutely.
There's a narrative feature I saw called The Line. It's a first-time filmmaker named Ethan Berger, and apparently he's been working on this a long time, but it stars Alex Wolff, you know, from Hereditary and so forth. It's a really good performance, very intense story of frat hazing, basically, and when it goes too far. Yeah, what was interesting to me is Frederic Boyer, who's the artistic director who you know as well.
Yeah.
He said this was like the best American film that they had. And he's this great, you know, Frenchman who thinks about cinema in a very French sort of way. And the French love these stories of like the complexities of American society, you know, almost from an anthropological perspective. So I think that's what he was enjoying about this like fairly unnerving story of frat life. I was just watching it and I was like, I can't believe these things still exist. But it's a very well-directed movie, and it's an acquisition title at the festival. It's got John Malkovich in a supporting role as a professor at the school, and Denise Richards is in it as his wife, and there are conversations about privilege and how they inform this system, and so it was a good movie. Where it goes from here, I don't know.
That's the thing about Tribeca. It's almost like you know, it's like, I don't know. I hate to say it. It's almost B tier. You know, you just don't know if there's going to be a breakout that's going to hit in a big way. Like I saw something called the Gullspang Miracle, another doc from Norway and Sweden. And it's a first time filmmaker, and it's nothing I would make any claims about in terms of some kind of, you know, awards contention, but it's a fascinating family mystery unraveling about twins. And I think people are always interested in twins and what happens. And there's a reason why these two twins were separated, but one died and one lived.
Mm.
And that woman goes back and meets the whole other part of her family that she
sounds like a bit of a Three Identical Strangers vibe.
Exactly. It's not on that level at all, but it's fascinating nonetheless, just the human dynamics of it.
Well,
and
Frederic,
you feel for this woman.
Yeah, that sounds actually, that makes me want to scope it out. Frederic was really high on the Rock Hunt, Hudson doc, Rock
right?
Hudson, All That Heaven Allowed. So I'm definitely going to try to see that one. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting time, you know, digging through this lineup. I mean, I always find Tribeca challenging as well, because it's a big festival of new movies and I live here. So it's like, if I was in Sundance or in Cannes, you know, you're
be
in
more
festival
intense
mode.
About it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I got to pick my moments in a way to go to brave the smoke, although it seems to be blowing.
No, I'm
away
coming
now.
To New York to see The Flash. Yeah, that's what's going on. You know, I'm not. There's a screening of Elemental. Yep. There's a screening of The Flash. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. So meanwhile, last week we talked a bit about Spider-Verse opening and Past Lives opening and Oscar season starting of sorts with those.
Yeah, no. The point with Past Lives is that it's so good and it has such an imprimatur as the best movie of the year so far. That's what everybody keeps sort of claiming, and they're right. It is. It's extraordinary, and I think it will. But a limited opening is a limited opening. It's easy to get high numbers there.
Sure.
It's when it goes wide that the truth will be told.
Yeah, and that's a tough wide release film any way you slice it, you know, but
I
mean, it's not
some time, but still it's a tough one.
It's not Beau's Afraid.
That's,
I mean,
with all those Oscar movies last year, they hung out in limited and did okay, and then when they went wider they didn't sustain.
Yeah, it has to be a slow rollout with, you know, constant excitement where it lands. I mean, the thing is, like A24 with Beau's Afraid, that was never going to go wide and succeed, because not only was it, you know, a crazy movie, it divided people. It didn't get like unanimous critical approval or whatever. Past Lives, it has to be this sort of delicate gem that continuously gets discovered as it travels around, you know, whereas like Spider-Verse, that's like an easy one. It just landed and everyone was excited. Well,
the trick on that, what I found interesting about that was that the tracking was inaccurate. So there's a lot with animated films, with family films, that's often true, that tracking doesn't tell the tale. So they were underestimating how well it was going to do. And then it was, again, the word of mouth on it was that it was the best thing to come in a long time. It was even better than the original. And it is. It's fantastic. I recommend it.
I'll be curious to see if, I mean, the middle movie of a trilogy ends up having the same sort of awards traction for the best animated
feature. Oh, it will. It could win. It could win animated feature again. I don't see a problem with that.
You know, something
I haven't seen Elemental yet.
Yeah, that's right. You got to see that one. But then there's also a dark horse, but it was an interesting discovery out of Cannes this year that Neon picked up for $1 million.
Too small, too
robot
little,
dreams.
Too unimpressive in terms of the actual compare Robot Dreams just in terms of the scale and scope to Spider-Verse. You can't. I mean, there's
I'm just saying it's not a sequel or something. Maybe there is a knock.
It's a lovely movie. I hope people.
They're also
see
both
it.
New York films. They're both
great. It's a lovely movie. I'm very fond of that movie, but there's no comparison.
Well, that'll be a fun one to argue about. We'll see how that field shapes up. And then the other one that you wrote about this week, and we talked a bit about this, it's still around the corner. Asteroid City opens next week, but there is this really interesting question of, you know,
that's the one more than Past Lives that's perceived as a possible commercial breakout. And, you know, Wes Anderson has had hugely commercial movies in the past, like The Grand Budapest Hotel and Moonrise Kingdom did okay too. And Budapest was the big Oscar contender that boosted its numbers over time. It opened in the early part of the year and lasted all the way through award season. Mm-hmm. And it ended up winning 4 Kraft Oscars. It got nominated for picture and director and everything, but in screenplay. But this one, it's a big question mark. It's a comedy. It's incredibly fun and accessible, but there are people who love Wes, people who don't love Wes.
Sure.
The question of who's going to show up in the theaters, the distributors spoke to me and said, this is the canary in the coal mine. This is the one that's going to tell us if they're going to come back, because it's a fun movie. It's a lot of fun.
You know, the thing that's interesting about it is that it's hard to explain it to people, like what it is. You kind of have to experience it to know what it is. Like if you see
that
the trailer,
could be an asset that could make people curious to see it.
Since we spoke last week, I got this book in the mail called Do Not Destruct, that was created with Jake Perlin, who's his curator. He used to be the artistic director for the Metrograph, and he's close with Wes Anderson. He does this whole interview with him in the book, which is also a collection of different sources that inspired the movie. And you can tell what they're doing, putting this thing out there. It's that it's out there to help explain what Wes is doing, playing with 50s Americana, as well as, you know.
So he's got a Bad Day at Black Rock, I believe, is one of the films that he was inspired by. Right?
And a lot of a Marilyn Monroe stuff, obviously, with Scarlett Johansson's character. And so there's
the Misfits.
Photos of her on The Misfits are in the book and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's about sort of getting people on board with this very layered approach that's both about the history of the country, but also the history of storytelling in the country. And it's still very Wes Anderson, so you got to be on that wavelength. So I don't know.
It's not intellectually challenging. It's just, you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention to the windows, the framing, the devices, right, the way that he goes from one space to another, which is really fun. But he's just having fun with it. That's the thing. Someone like Scarlett Johansson in this movie is just hilarious and delightful and really good at what she does. But at the same time, none of those people are going to be Oscar contenders, because there's too many of them and they don't have enough time.
So speaking of upcoming releases that may or may not be Oscar contenders, you finally got a chance to catch up on Indiana Jones. I've been dying.
This is
to
not
talk
an
to you about
Oscar
that one.
Contender.
You know, Harrison Ford is finally gonna.
I
gonna put him
am
the top.
Original. I remember seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark in a screening room at Paramount Pictures in New York when the big Gulf and Western building was there on 59th Street in Broadway. Amazing.
The first shot of the movie.
Yeah. And it was incredible to see that movie because Spielberg and Lawrence Kasdan and they reinvented something. They took an old form and made it new. And the problem now is the challenge for someone like James Mangold taking over from Spielberg after all these movies, after four movies. He is actually tasked with keeping something very old fashioned that is very old now, really.
Right. It's and a formula crusty, that sort of lingered.
How do you keep it fresh? So I think he did as good a job as anybody who wasn't Spielberg could do.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time that you are going through one chase scene after another.
Well, the
there
point
are a lot of chase scenes.
Well, the point of comparison I made earlier, I think when David and I did Screen Talk at Cannes, is like it reminded me a bit of the Star Wars reboot sequel, whatever you requel, I don't know what the term is for Force Awakens, where it's like you've been here before and it's being designed to satisfy that desire to go back to that place.
Absolutely.
It's not trying
to
be
new. Do the nostalgia thing that J.J. Abrams was capable of doing. And there's a moment, I won't spoil, where Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones is reunited with a character from the old, or a couple places where he gets to see people that were in the
callbacks.
Old films. And they're wonderful. And you respond
you
to them.
You could feel the pause for applause,
absolutely.
Right?
You
heard it in the palate. You
feel the affection that has been built up for these people. You feel the affection that's been built up for Indiana Jones. The trick there too was I see what they were trying to do with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and it was a very tricky thing to pull off.
It's interesting seeing her in this role because she hasn't really had a prominent role since Fleabag, and it's I mean, outside of the fact that she's like still sarcastic and funny. It's
and athletic, and she's like Indiana Jones. She's you know, she punches people and does stunts and steals cars and drives, and you know, they modernize by the way, Marion Ravenwood was always a modern woman.
Yeah, she really deserved a spinoff of her own or something.
I think so.
Yeah,
I always loved Karen Allen. I always loved her to death.
Yeah, well, she's still
around. But this is really fun. I think people will enjoy it at the same time that the critics have reasons for having, you know, certainly plenty of reasons for having doubts about it.
That's what I came out of Cannes feeling like. It was sort of the inverse of, you know, when Crystal Skull premiered at Cannes, I think the critics were actually relatively kind to it because of the Spielberg factor, but the fans really revolted against that movie. And this one, not so much. I feel like it's a critics
were
harsh.
It's tracking to open at about something like $70 million, respectable, not super over the top. It just feels like it's going to be an older audience that goes to this movie, that's the target audience, the people who grew up on the Indiana Jones movies. Are you the target audience for this movie?
Well, I grew up on those movies. I mean, you know, it was sort of like, it was in some ways, it was like your first, for a lot of people my generation, your first like cinematic experience was going through this franchise, because the first one is such great filmmaking in particular. So I think that the appeal probably goes through, you know, the older millennial side of things.
I think
the
so.
Gen Z, not so much, I'm sure.
I agree. I think you're at the younger end. I would say people in their 30s are the younger end of this, of the demo. By the way, Harrison Ford is extraordinarily good. And I didn't have any trouble at all with the de-aging. And I'm very picky about that stuff. I am
very
aware of of what goes on with CGI.
It's gotten very good. And the other part of it,
there are a couple places where you catch a bad tooth or something on the side, but for the most part, it's good.
Well, I mean, so at the Cannes press conference, he talked about this because, I mean, it's not the whole movie. It's like the first big passage.
The movie starts with young Indiana Jones.
But they had, Lucasfilm had decades of footage of Harrison Ford throughout the years to draw from. So it's about as good as it can be right now in terms
you
of what they
had. You can tell they used
his
real body, too.
Yeah, the one thing that
I doubt that they used his real body all the time, but enough so that you bought it.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that tripped me up, it wasn't teeth, it was the voice. I think the voice is less convincing than the face.
You had to buy it. You had to buy old Harrison Ford voice.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I happened to talk to Frank Marshall this week about, because he's coming to Tribeca with this doc that he directed about Dan Rather and produced the movie, obviously. And he was saying, like, because they had so much material to work with, this is not some new normal that people should be panicking about, you know. And I know we want to talk about the, you know, SAG strike prospects and all that kind of stuff. I think it's worth looking at that. It's like, there is a real fear that this could happen all the time now.
The whole idea that actors could be replaced by digital actors is a real issue. And it's interesting how they're proposing to deal with that. It's fascinating. They have to get permission. They have to know when their likeness is going to be used. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to see how that plays out.
So it's been an interesting week for strike stuff, because the DGA voted in favor of a new contract.
They
with
haven't
the
voted
studios.
On it yet,
but they approved.
The rank and file will vote on it soon.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, you and others had said, you know, that was pretty likely to happen. The DGA doesn't usually go on strike. They went on strike for like a few hours, like 40 years ago or whatever.
It's easier to make them happy. It's easier. It just is. And everybody came out ahead. There was an interesting thing on Twitter this morning with Larry Charles, who's a writer director, explaining why.
Yeah.
He did not vote yes. He voted no in support of his writer buddies. He's a writer first. It's going to go through. It's not going to be. There isn't going to be a huge movement there. They're going to go with what's good for them. The question is what the actors are going to do and how far the AMT-PTP is going to go to make the actors happy.
Well, the WGA response to the DGA negotiation with the studios was very, very negative, you know, like that there was no solidarity, that, you know, it seemed like it was sort of using the labor tactics of the WGA to leverage a opportunity for
a deal.
They've
done this before where they divided, they stopped talking to the writers, right? They abandoned ship in order to go make a deal with the directors. That's basically what they did.
Yeah.
And they're probably planning to make a deal with the actors too and force the writers to capitulate and compromise. And that's what they've done all along. Yeah. And they're going to do it again.
I was talking to a prominent actor actually earlier today who was asking me if I thought this, you know, the SAG was going to go on strike. And he was saying, you know, before I would have said, yes, it's definitely going to happen because the strike authorization vote passed.
It was very high. The percentage.
It was very like 97 point something.
Really
percent.
High.
But now with the DGA deal, it's like maybe it won't. There's some sense of, well, maybe they'll figure something out here. So I don't know. I mean, none of these people want to go on strike because now nobody's going to, I mean, if they're after strike, really nothing happens.
The producers characterize the writers as being very hawkish in their negotiation approach.
Yeah.
And this is always true. This has been true from time immemorial, but the question, you know, it's going to be this way, likely, that the directors have their deal, maybe the actors make their deal. The writers will have to see what they did, see if they can make a peace with the same deals, or how they can improve on them for themselves. But they're not going to get everything they want. They just aren't. And they're going to have to come around to that eventually.
And the tone with the writers has been much more extreme in public, obviously, because of the picket lines, because you have a lot of people at the lower end of the totem pole fighting, you know, all these stories of people, you know, driving Ubers and so forth to get by. And the conversation about the economy of being a writer now is so much more extreme than it is around these other guilds.
But this is true across the industry. And that's what's so interesting about it, because you can't return to an old economy that no longer exists. There is no more 22 episode NBC series. You know, those things are rare now. And so the reality of the real world has to impinge on what's going to happen. And the story that Joe Adalian and another writer put into Vulture, I call it Vulture, you call it New York Magazine. It's an extraordinary piece of reporting, which I highly recommend everybody look at, because it's something that reflects months and months and months of work. They really draw a picture of the new economy, streaming economy. And they show what happened, how it started here, how it went here during the pandemic, how it peak TV happened, how it came back, how it's pulled back, how it's constricting now, and where it's going to be going, you know, after these strikes. And it's not a pretty picture. It's not going to be as much employment. It's going to be fewer films, fewer TV shows.
Yeah,
it's not a lot
too many
of work.
I mean, it yeah, did
for
get
people.
Over.
So it's a you know, sort of a reality check at a time when advertising is falling everywhere across the board, and layoffs at places like the LA Times, which just laid off 74 people.
And the studios too. I mean, Disney laid off
bigger numbers. Yeah.
So it's all across the board. There are these adjustments taking place. Yeah, I was thinking about this, and we were going to talk about The Idol. You know, had posted these numbers for the premiere, which had all this noise around it. You know, I saw the first two episodes at Cannes, and there was all this noise going into Cannes, and then it you know, less than 1 million people watched the first episode, and there's only 5 episodes, but there's this interesting question with the show like this of like, do the ratings really make that much of a difference, or does it accrue value over time?
It's a subscriber
like, it's really hard
base, to know. HBO, remember, you know, that's, it's always about that. You know, it isn't so much about the ratings, but you want to do well. If it starts at a low point, is it going to grow? Okay. So I watched one episode. You saw two, right?
Two. Yeah. Although they were sort of stitched together as a single thing, but there was a title credit when the second one started. So I kind of know where one ends.
So I'm a Euphoria fan, and Sam Levinson is actually adept. You know, he's a good writer. Yes. He's a good director. It's well made.
The internet hates him, but he is not untalented.
No, he is good. I actually fell for Malcolm and Marie. You know, I liked that. You know, other people didn't. So this is, you know, I watched it with a great deal of interest. Yes, there's a very distinct male gaze. You know, you are ogling this woman, but that's the point. She's supposed to be an object of desire. That is her. That is who she is. That is what she represents. And so the question going forward, I can't tell yet, is whether The Weeknd carries that character that he's playing, because he just very quickly introduced in the first episode.
Yeah, so he's this character, Tedros, who Lily Rose Depp's pop star character meets at a nightclub, and he like kind of infiltrates her life and is sort of this cultish character. And what you learn, without spoiling a ton, in the second episode is that his origins are very questionable. It's not really clear who this guy is. And he has this whole entourage that kind of moves with him. And, you know, she is very much this character who's attracted to danger. She's recovering from a mental illness and the loss of her mother, and something about the questions around him are actually attractive, like arousing to her. And so it's setting us up for that. But then
it was
also
interesting in the first episode, though, like he's a little bit, he has a rat tail. She sees him. She sees him as lower level, you know, low life. She sees him as scruffy, I think. And he is anxious about making a good appearance. He's, I mean, it isn't just that he's calculating how to make a good appearance, which is part of it, but there seemed to be real anxiety there also.
Yeah, and well, the way that The Weeknd, Abel Tesfaye, has talked about this is that it's like, this idea of, you know, somebody like him who didn't get the gratification of success, you know, and so he's sort of this villainous character who's trying to exploit her success to realize
so
what
he's a Svengali.
Yeah, I suppose so. My real question with it, because I've seen two episodes and I'm would like to see the rest, is what the payoff is going to be here. You know, does he become more sympathetic, or is he truly the villain and going to eat it at the end somehow? You know, does Lily Rose Depp's character get a kind of empowerment that we haven't seen yet? Because that's really where the backlash, I think, is coming from, on top of the male gaze stuff, is like, whose side is this show on?
It does. The good thing about Sam Levinson is that he does give some indication that there's an intelligence there with Lily Rose.
Yeah.
It isn't an entirely shallow portrayal. She has words. She has thoughts. There's a part where she's talking to the Vanity Fair writer who was good.
Played by Hari Neff. Yeah,
exactly. And so that was an interesting conversation. You know, I mean, at least we're not dealing with a complete bimbo here.
No, and the show is very self-aware about how people may have issues with it. And of course, that itself allows people to have issues with it. So it's like layer upon layer. And, you know, I can't keep track of all this stuff, but watching the show did make me want to see where it goes. So I will keep watching. I assume you're going to continue to plug
in. I think I will. Yeah, no, yeah. There was a scene. You're right. Because there was a scene where all the grownups, all the manager, the PR guy, I always love Jane Addams, you know, all of these people Jane are Adams, watching.
Hank Azaria.
Thank you.
Eli Roth.
He's hilarious. He's hilarious. Yeah. So I was amused by them. They're all up on a balcony looking down on this dance sequence, which very provocative, sexy dance sequence. You're right. He's playing around with the voyeuristic aspects of this.
So to be continued on that front. Meanwhile, we've got some big movies around the corner. So next week we get to do our Screen Talk Live edition at Tribeca for the first time.
And we'll talk about The Flash then.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. So that is next Thursday at 4:00 p.m. Eastern. And if people are in New York, they should come. I think tickets are free online, and you could see on our social where to do that and ping us if you have any questions. But it's always fun to have you. And the first time we did this was on the rooftop at Tribeca
that
in 2020.
That was so fun.
It was like right at the first time that all people were actually doing stuff in the COVID era, as it were. So it'll be nice to come back under newer conditions. And I think the smoke will clear up for you, Anne. I hope so.
You can help us out. I'm bringing my masks. All right.
All right.
I have some leftovers.
Oh, good.
Okay.
See you soon.
Right. See you
Bye.
Then.